Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is August Baker. Today, I have the great privileged to be speaking with Professor Alice Jardine. Alice is a professor at Harvard University. She's worked at the forefront of critical thought since the 80s. Wide-ranging work. Prominent are issues of women, gender, and sexuality, and the analysis of politics, culture, and society. And today we're speaking with Professor Jardine about her recent book, which is the first biography of another public intellectual, specifically the inimitable Julia Kristeva. The book is called At the Risk of Thinking, An Intellectual Biography of Julia Kristeva. One of the endorsements for the book was by Noel McAfee, and I thought it captured Alice's book very well. McAfee said, quote, "With a light and magical touch, Alice Jardine narrates the story of Julia Kristeva's journey from the Black Sea to the Atlantic to the expanse of human singularity. In her intimate account, Jardine shows how Kristeva became one of the most extraordinary intellectuals of our era. For every reader, here is a story that will inspire us all to think more deeply, to revolt against preconceptions, and to become our own force in creating the meaning of our lives." I thought that captured, that's the end of the quote. I thought that was beautifully said and very true. It was an inspiring book for me to read. The book has been very well received, including winning 2021 Choice Outstanding Academic title. Welcome, Alice.
Hello, August. Thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
We are speaking on March 29th, 2022, and about a month ago, Russia invaded Ukraine. One of the things you say in your book is that the stories dominating Kristeva's earliest memories of her childhood were shaped by two devastating totalitarian invasions.
Yes, indeed. So perhaps for your listeners, I'll clarify that the book is divided into three parts. And the first part covers the years from Kristeva's birth in 1941 in Sliven, Bulgaria, until 1965, and Kristeva's departure for Paris. And the second part is her adventures in Paris. And the third part is a sort of overview of her life and work over the last few decades since the 1980s. That first part was absolutely the most challenging part to write, in part because of my own ignorance about Eastern Europe and certainly about the history of Bulgaria, but also because I was writing it during the Trump administration. and the echoes and reverberations and strange complexities of listening, both to that historical moment of Kristeva's childhood in Bulgaria and what was happening in the United States. And it also brought up a lot of Kristeva's concepts and vocabulary. She writes about radical evil. She writes about the death drive, et cetera, which maybe we'll have time to get to, which of course makes today talking about this book with you and her childhood today even more intense. So what I meant by the statement about her memories and these invasions, of course, is referring to the fact that Bulgaria was neutral, tried to be neutral, before the Second World War, but entered as a member of the Axis powers. And it came into the war with the Nazis, but also took a lot of distance from the Nazi regime and, for example, refused or tried to refuse to round up Jewish people and would not comply with various demands of the Nazi regime. And then by the summer of 1944, the Soviets were coming in through Romania, and Bulgaria got in trouble with the Soviets, who then declared war on Bulgaria and invaded in September of 44. And Kristeva, of course, was a young child in Sliven, Bulgaria, and she, as she recalls those years, early years of her childhood, she evokes, for example, going down to the basement of her parents' home and listening to Radio London. And she gets quite excited when she talks about that. It's a very vivid memory in her mind because they had to be very quiet. And meanwhile, they were watching through the windows at the upper wall of the basement. And she, as she puts it, first there were Nazi boots and then there were Soviet boots.
Wow.
The other things that she tends to talk about, which I try to talk about in the book, tends to be at the level of affect or emotion. She talks about fear. She talks about hearing rumors of horrible things and running through the streets to get home. She talks about a sense of regulation, always having what she needed, but not what she wanted. And she tells stories about going to her friend's house and her friend's mother giving her friend one teaspoon of water at a time and no more. She talks about disappointment. She talks about her, especially her father's enormous disappointment that he's trying to raise his daughters in this place that he calls the intestines of hell.
And he wanted to become a priest originally. Is that right?
He did. He was a very devout Orthodox Christian who had studied theology and wanted to continue in his efforts to be a theologian, and of course couldn't. Toyed with the idea of becoming a doctor, and that was not a good idea. So because he wanted his daughters to be educated in Sofia, he became part of essentially the sort of Sovietized ministry of religion. But he wrote a lot. He wrote a lot of essays, sort of in secret, and continued to believe for a very long time, even though they had to be very careful not to let the authorities see them going sneaking off to communion, you know, early at dawn. Yeah.
One of the things you say is, all my childhood was bathed in this. The smell of the incense, the profusion of flowers on the altar. Beautiful.
Yes. And she has talked quite a lot about the fact that Bulgaria itself, you know, is so full of contradiction and so full of, you know, it's where Christianity and Islam and Judaism all met. And then, you know, there were the Turks and there were the Nazis and there were the Soviets. And she really sees herself as having taken in history and sort of become a product of history. And then she always pauses and says, but what really stuck was those memories of in the early morning in the monastery or in the church with my father. It was the music, it was the art, it was the music, it was the smell of the flowers. And eventually those sensations, those affects, I think became for her a symbol, maybe not quite the right word, but certainly an evocation of that which escapes the kind of rationality of Soviet identity in that case. But even later for her, I think it evokes what she will later in her work call the semiotic, you know, that which is not part of meaning and logic and rationality. And she's always been more drawn, I think, to that sort of mystical magic than to logic and rationality.
Well, this is, I'm just kind of free associating here, but one of the things I was really interested in, so she resisted her father's religiosity for a long time. And one of the stories you tell in the book is about ultimately her representing atheism at the at a conference with the Pope. Could you tell our listeners about that?
Yes. So she had given a huge lecture, public lecture in Italy, on her book on Teresa. And there were some representatives from the Vatican at that lecture, and they were very taken with her. And she is very clear that she's an atheist. I mean, she may have these mystical memories, but she is a bona fide atheist. And so slowly but surely, she began to receive invites to appear at this event in, I believe it was October of 2011. It was an event organized by Pope Benedict the 16th, where a representative from the majority of the world's religions were going to gather in order to discuss the future of the church. And for the first time in history, they invited an atheist. So I include in the book this photograph that I still find
stunning,
quite astonishing.
Yes.
With all of these men lined up in a row from every possible outfit.
Yes, costume and, or religious and, outfit, yeah.
Yes, and Kristeva at the very end, standing there very modestly, right? And she spoke last, actually. They all spoke, and she spoke last. And Pope Benedict actually was very moved by what she had to say.
Right.
And he afterwards made the remarks, looking at all of these representatives, he said, you know, no one owns the truth.
Right. Outstanding. Yeah. That was quite a story. If we go back, there were four, if we go back to her early childhood, it's interesting. She says there were two stories she wanted the readers to know. And at one point you address the reader and say, there are also two stories about Kristeva's childhood that I want you to know. Could you tell, I guess that's four stories total. Could you give us one or two of those stories, whichever appeals to you at the moment?
Of course. Well, I'll be self-involved and tell you what I think your listeners might want to know if they've read any Kristeva or know of her and her work. Because I didn't know these stories until like 2011 or 12. And it made so much sense to me. So briefly, one of them was that she hated, when she was a young girl, she hated girl stuff. She was given a dollhouse and she loathed it. She wanted to to destroy it. She hated the little dolls in the dollhouse. And she would evidently just, you know, stomp around screaming that she didn't want to do all of that. She didn't want to wash the dishes and dress the dolls, et cetera. And the other, and that said a lot. And she talks about her books and how those were the precious items locked away in the cupboard. The other story she told me also made a lot of sense to me. It was new to me when she told me that she almost never cried as a child, like almost never. And she would do things like, and she was very famous for it when she was quite young. She and her mother would be walking in the park and Kristeva would just take off running.
Yeah.
And she'd run and run and run as fast as she could until she'd fall down. And she'd stand up and she'd have scratches and blood and it would be a mess. And her mother would come running. What have you done? And she would say, Kristeva would say, she'd touch her mother's face very gently and say, "Oh, mama, don't worry. I'll take care of you." And that's just like,
that was such a great story. Yeah.
That said a lot.
It certainly did. I love that. Let's jump ahead. There's so much to cover. She started out as a journalist, and it's difficult for us to imagine what it must have been like to be a journalist. I mean, for her high school newspaper, it's difficult for us to imagine what it would have been like to be a journalist in a communist country. And she wrote some things that put her family at some risk, even when she was a teenager, or I guess when she was 21.
She was 21, yeah.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of things to say about that period that, again, I don't think very many Anglophone readers know a lot about. So when she began writing as a journalist quite young, in her teens, actually, mainly for money, for extra money, and eventually became quite well known because of her ability to write in a very palimpsestic or kind of camouflaged kind of way. Mm, mm-hmm. She seemed to have the ability to write a sort of surface level story that would adhere to what the authorities and censors wanted, but she could wind through it the stories that she actually wanted to tell. And she was very good at it. And in just before she left for Paris, actually, 1962, she was 21 years old. And there was a dissident journalist named Albert Cohn, who had written a book, and no one... Roads and Stops. And no one wanted to review it because it was very much written in, it was the Khrushchev era, it was very much written in the spirit of the thaw, as they called it. In other words, a kind of renewed openness to the Western world and, you know, a lot of literary exploration. And no one wanted to review it, except, of course, our young Kristeva, who perhaps naively, you know, wrote this, you know, absolutely sparkling review of the book. And the next day on the front page of the communist newspaper, there was a headline that said, "Julia Kristeva, cosmopolitan agent of the capitalist hyena."
Oh my gosh.
She was called a spy. She was called a Zionist, which was, of course, an insult. And they were terrified. And her father, who was probably the most aware of the dangers of this kind of thing, you know, took her to a monastery and they sort of hid out because he was afraid they were going to be sent away to a camp. And then to make everything worse, Radio Free Europe wrote a whole front, you know, did a whole session on how brilliant she was. Nothing happened to them. And I suggest that this may have been because she was not particularly political in the public sphere, except for this camouflaged writing.
Right.
And she was becoming quite well known as a translator. And for example, she took the cosmonauts around.
Yeah.
So this time period when she was writing is really, really important to understand. I think she even wrote a book that nobody knows about, which I'm trying to get translated. 1964, she published a book called Characteristic Trends in 20th Century Western Literature.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, the more I looked at this time period when she was with all of these dissident journalists and dissident intellectuals, including her sweetheart, Svetan Stoyanov, that's really when she began to become Julia Kristeva, mm-hmm. In an odd kind of way. I mean, this writing, you know, which Stoyanov actually called a theoretical hurricane. He said, you know, Julia, you write these theoretical hurricanes. What she was trying to do was camouflage what she was actually writing, which was a kind of already a kind of window on the Western world. In some ways, almost a preview of some of her earliest works in French,
mm-hmm.
which many readers in French, in English, and many other languages find very, very hard to read.
Right.
Very interesting. Hard. And I think it's from that time.
You know, gets out of Bulgaria and goes to France, which easily could not have happened. It's kind of a miracle that it did happen. December 15th, 1965, she gets on a plane to Paris with $5. It's easy to romanticize that, but I think what I found from your book was that it was, extremely difficult to leave her home and her family and go and learn to think in a new language, and it wasn't this heady intellectual time when she first got to Paris.
No, that's right. And this was another discovery for me, because I think I had sort of bought into that myth of, oh, Kristeva, you know, she went off to Paris and, you know, became immediately part of the scene there. Well, no, not exactly. She desperately missed her intellectual community in Sofia. And in fact, in the book, I explain that I think part of her ability to find Roland Barthes and Emile Benveniste and all of these other extraordinary intellectuals of the time was her effort to recreate that sense of mm-hmm. being center of the world and being able to really think out loud with like-minded friends. And but as she was looking for these friends, she was quite depressed. She missed her community, she missed her boyfriend, Svetan, she missed her parents dreadfully. Mm. She, as you said, she was trying to learn to write in French and felt like her Bulgarian self was dying. She couldn't quite figure out how to do that. It took quite a long time. But eventually, because of this sort of parade of amazing mentors, she was able to find a community in Paris, mm-hmm. and eventually find her way and publish, and, you know, the rest is literature. She just never stopped.
Right.
Met her husband-to-be and got married in 1967. And so she did manage to do it, but it wasn't easy. It was hard. And a couple of times she got very sick. In fact, it was one of the reasons she and Philippe Solers got married, was she was really, really sick and had been working so hard. Don't forget, she thought she had to go back to Bulgaria. She thought she was only there for a year. And so she was just, you know, she was like a sponge. She was just going to everything and doing everything. She got really sick. And because she was from a communist country, they wouldn't let her give her a hospital room. And lots of stories about that. And then eventually she and Solas got married, and she was able to get the medical care she needed and become more integrated into French culture, which she did more or less.
This was one of the funny things you said in the book, it is actually hard for me to think of Julia Kristeva as anyone's wife, especially.
I know, that's especially so. Slipped out. My editors didn't catch that. Yeah, it, you know, the whole, I talk a lot in the book. I mean, I write quite extensively about that relationship, which I've come to accept and I've come to understand better than I used to. He is such a character. And he is such a brilliant writer.
I don't think that our listeners probably know about Dominique Rolland. Also,
no, they probably don't. Yeah. So the short version is that when Kristeva met her future husband, Philippe Solaps, he was already very involved with a Belgian writer, a very well-known Belgian writer named Dominique Rolland, and who was much older than Solaps. I think she was 45. He was, you know, 20 something. And anyway, long story short, he Solaps made it very clear to Kristeva that this was a lifetime relationship. And in fact, it was. She passed away, Dominique Rolland passed away, I think it was 2012, off the top of my head. And they were quite loyal to each other. And Kristeva never, ever experienced any jealousy in her telling. And of course, the reason she gives is that her father loved her so much, so much, that it didn't bother her. It was Roland was very good for Solaps's writing, which was the most important thing to him. And so why not? Why be jealous? She said.
Right. Quoting her, "I was never jealous of my mother, convinced as I was that my father preferred me to her and to everyone else for that matter. It's my symptom to believe it, certainly, unless it's my strength."
Yeah, yeah. That relationship between Kristeva and her father, you know, I'm sure there's much more to write about. It was absolutely determinant. Yes.
And he told her to stand upright.
Yes.
Stand up straight in the name. Kneel with a very straight back in a corner.
Yes, that was, she was supposed to be the older sister. She has the younger sister, very talented musician. And Kristeva was supposed to be she was supposed to be grown up, and she was supposed to control her temper and behave. And, you know, I keep saying that's why she has so much spine. She's so determined and so strong. And I think, you know, that early relationship with her father was part of that. Her mother too, though, you know, we didn't say very much about her mother, who was a very brilliant scientist, mathematician, with a creative side. She was also an illustrator, but she was really the exact opposite of Kristeva's father, you know, the sort of rational mathematician who helped Kristeva with her schoolwork.
right. So she's becomes a essayist, journalist, essayist, academic, a professor, public intellectual. And then at a certain point, she decides to go into psychoanalysis and eventually become a psychoanalyst. You say at one point, to read, I think quoting her, or no, this is you, "To read, to listen, to think was not enough. She needed to feel implicated."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell us about the decision to go into psychoanalysis, and also maybe something about her analyst?
Yes. So I think that desire to be implicated, to remain implicated, is I would almost say characterological of Kristeva. She always, you know, it reminds me of when I was a young student in New York and she was writing an essay on the avant-garde, the American avant-garde. And she pulled me in her office and said, okay, we have to go and see five avant-garde productions of some kind in New York. I was like 22. I don't know. I was like, okay. Because she wanted to be, she wanted to experience it firsthand. And I would say that because she had been to Lacan's seminars in Paris, and because she was beginning to circulate in the Tel-Quel group, and not only with Solers, her husband, but with other members of Tel-Quel, many of whom were deeply involved with psychoanalytic theory, she began, and because of her passion for language and her belief that we are all implicated, not just implicated, but, you know, actually constructed by mm-hmm. language, she wanted to go on the couch. She wanted to speak her implication in all of these ideas that she was writing about academically, theoretically. Mm-hmm. And she asked a few friends, it's a long story, but eventually she was sort of moved towards Isbahand, a German analyst who has a long and interesting story herself as a Jewish woman, with a very sad long story in occupied France. But Kristeva, who at that point was deeply immersed in Melanie Klein and Winnicott and others, discovered in Barand an intelligence that both reassured her about her sense of language, the magic of language, the importance, existential importance of artistic and literary consciousness. So she found someone who shared her, I guess, for lack of a better word, I'll say epistemology, mm-hmm. but shared what she cared about, but also someone who challenged her at every turn and who did not, you know, and I think I tell the story about, you know, going and interviewing and seeing if it was a right fit. Mm-hmm. And Kristeva, you know, talking about how her relationship with her mother was like a ball bouncing on the floor, that she just touched her mother, but never actually got to...
Stayed a bit, never stayed a bit.
Yeah, yeah. And Baron said, okay, you start now. Right. It was clear. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, what was fascinating about that story, to go into analysis, but she had no idea she would become an analyst when she started.
Okay.
But the analysis led her to three things that for Anglophone readers are essential. It led her to feminism because she decided that she needed to go to China because she needed to feel implicated if she was going to write about ideograms, etc. So she was going to go to China, and which is a whole story I tell, which there are some funny bits.
Yes.
She is going to go to China, and then she's going to write a book, Chinese Women, for this notorious publishing firm, Des Femmes. And through that essay and through that book and through that experience, she became a feminist in the eyes of American readers. She decided that she would become an analyst. This was quite far along in the process. Mm-hmm. She said, I think this is for me. And third, she decided to become a mother. And those were the three huge, huge decisions that had, you know, reverberating consequences that came out of that decision.
Yeah. You mentioned becoming a mother. Tell us about our readers. Another thing that I didn't know about her son, is it David?
David.
Yes, David.
David is a miracle. David is extraordinary, an extraordinary human being for whom I have enormous affection. I tell the story of Kristeva's pregnancy, which was quite unexceptional. And then David was born and adored, and then they began to see that something wasn't quite right. Mm-hmm. And it turned out, long story short, that David had what they call an orphan disease, but a neurological disorder that led to a series of physical disabilities. But David never lost an ounce, or even less than an ounce is, of his intelligence and memory. He has photographic memory, and is very witty and smart. And
you can imagine that Stoyan gave to Kristeva, she passed on to David.
Yeah. David is very special. He's now, you know, an adult man who writes and who thinks and who plays, and you know, he's a remarkable human being. But I think, you know, for Kristeva, as soon as she realized that she had a disabled child, she had to find a way to continue as an analyst, continue as a writer, continue as a professor, continue as a wife, continue as a world traveler, mm-hmm. and continue as the mother of a disabled son.
It's just inspiring. Yeah.
She has done brilliantly.
Yes. One point, I think you refer to the marches that she would listen to in Bulgaria, kind of march on.
Yes. That was a discovery. She has gone back to Bulgaria a couple of times to make films. I was, of course, watching all of these films. And in one of them, I'd have to look up the title of it, but it shows her, she joined during the alphabet ceremony that she had participated in as a child, mm-hmm. which basically is a celebration of the monks who invented the Slavic alphabet. And in once a year, children all over Bulgaria put on a letter that they parade around, mm-hmm. in. It's a celebration of the alphabet.
In no other country is there a celebration of the alphabet that I know of. That's interesting.
I've learned that there are kind of mini celebrations in other parts of Eastern Europe, but I haven't been able to track down exactly where. Mm-hmm. Her one of these films showed her at one of these alphabet celebrations in May, and she began marching with the crowd. And it was just extraordinary to suddenly see this very elegant Parisian woman suddenly marching, you know, with such vehemence and singing this, you know, Sovietized marching song about writing. It's about writing.
Right.
It was extraordinary. Right. All of these parts of her, she's quite a puzzle.
Yeah. You said that it was on the couch. I'm sorry. It feels like I'm rushing. There's so much to cover. You said that on the couch that Kristeva found many of her best ideas, and you refer to Julia's conceptual toolbox. That's a big topic, but could you just give an overview of that?
Well, yeah, I can say a few short things about that. So the most famous example of that is when she was in analysis with Ilse Bond. She was saying, oh, my mother's here. Oh, my God, and there's the baby. And I'm writing this book on Celine, and it's so abject. And Isbalm said, oh, that's the word you want. And the notion of abjection became one of Kristeva's most famous concepts. What I call when in my courses, especially with my grad students, what I call her conceptual toolbox, I guess I could summarize very quickly as, first of all, having to do with the question of the intellectual. Mm-hmm. How can you be an intellectual? Certainly today in 2022, how can you be an intellectual? She talks about being contestatory.
Right.
She talks about putting reliance and care at the center of one's practice, you know, as opposed to aggression and mm-hmm. one-upmanship, et cetera. And secondly, I would say there's a batch of concepts that have to do with going back to concepts that have been very important historically in Western philosophy and not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as it were. She wants to reinvent humanism. She wants to rethink universalism. She wants to get away from talking about identity and focus on subjectivity, very much in the psychoanalytic sense. And then thirdly and lastly, I think she really wants intellectuals to think about vulnerable subjects. Okay. All of the kinds of human subjects were vulnerable
and marginalized.
Exactly. And especially because she believes that one of the things that the Western world is suffering from right now, and not only the Western world, but maybe especially, is what she calls an ideality disorder, just meaning briefly that because of the assault of technology on our psyches, we've lost our capacity for psychic space, mm-hmm. and we are losing our idealism. Mm-hmm. We're becoming disappointed and distressed about our ideals that we had believed in, and now we're not so sure. And she really sees that as a serious crisis that needs addressing.
Right. One of the things I really liked about your book is that you go through her, I don't know which section it is, but you go through, she's there's so many ideas which one associates with Kristeva. And what I found really helpful was that if you want to see her thoughts on the death drive, here's the book. When she talked about being a mother of a child with a disability, here's where you look. If you want to look at the need to believe and the desire to know, here's the book. You know, it's kind of like you and a large annotated bibliography, if you will.
Well, thank you for saying that, because that was one of my intentions.
Yeah, because otherwise you don't know what to buy. There's so much. And this way you can zero in on what you want to see.
Yeah, I say in the introduction that, you know, Kristeva's relationship to this biography, you know, it's the first one, there'll be many more. I had to be very careful. She doesn't want her private life aired until after her demise, you know. And then I said, you know, in my relationship to the book, you know, is really about not, you know, praising her or putting her on a pedestal, but really trying to honestly recount her life as I believe she's lived it. And then my reader's relationship, I wrote it for interested non-specialist readers. And so what better thing could I do than, you know, sort of point towards various kinds of readings, because there's so much.
Right.
There's so much. I try to mention, you know, I think I say at one point, you know, I'm trying to mention 50 books, you know, something about 50 books that isn't just a throwaway line or something terribly superficial, or but to actually say something meaningful that will make my reader want to go read that book.
No, absolutely. You succeed brilliantly at that.
Thank you.
Oh boy, we're running out of time. Can you tell us, what is this Sabina?
Ooh, how long do we have?
In 30 seconds. No, go, I'm just kidding. Tell us, what is this?
Okay, so the short version is that in the former communist countries of Eastern Europe, various kinds of archives were set up that were attempting to identify folks who had been working secretly with the communist regimes and were agents or spies, if you like. And those archives in Bulgaria were declassified in 2007. And lo and behold, slowly it became apparent that Kristeva was named in those archives and that she had been an agent of the DAS, of the horrible secret service. There's a lot to say about this, but in 2018, in March of March 28th, 2018, I got a phone call that it was public that she had been named. And of course, she was aghast. She was horrified and has denied it totally. And when the New York Times called me and asked me what I thought, I said, almost without thinking, I believe her. I believe her completely. And I go through all the reasons why, but I said, the most important reason is that if she had been forced in order to protect her own life or the life of her family to do that, she would have written about it when the wall came down. She couldn't have helped herself.
Right.
The thing that's so sad, I'll just say this quickly, I know we're running out of time, but the thing that's so sad about this whole affair, really, ultimately, is that, you know, I mentioned her sweetheart, Svetan Stoyanov, back in Bulgaria. In early 1971, he accepted a challenge to go and try to convince Georgi Markov, who's probably one of the most famous poisoned dissidents in history.
With the umbrella.
With the umbrella tip, right. Mm-hmm, to convince Markov to come back to Bulgaria. And he failed. He did not, her sweetheart did not convince Markov to come back to Sofia. And in mid-June of 1971, when Svetan Stoyanov and Julia Kristeva were the two most famous intellectuals in Bulgaria, Stoyanov died. He died under very strange circumstances. And one has to be very careful because there's no proof, but I believe that he was killed by the DAS. And in the archive that names Kristeva as a spy, they give mid-June 1971 as the date of her engagement as a spy. And what's sad, really sad, is from that moment on, from mid-June 1971, they surveilled her and her husband and her child and her family. And we still don't quite know what they did, what they threatened her parents with back in Bulgaria. And she had no idea. And it's called blind surveillance. I mean, it was a technical kind of surveillance. And it really devastated her. And it really devastated her that the Western press jumped on it and didn't question all of this fake news, all of this politicking from a period that very few Anglophones understand. So
her self-defense, when she is asked,
she didn't know. And when they bring up like, well, you had tea with Mr. Kostov.
Yes, I did.
And he had sent me books from France when I was a student in Bulgaria. I had no idea he was a spy.
Right.
Of course, he actually had left Bulgaria in 1977. He wanted no more of it. But in any case, she has answers, you know, well, what about the time you said power to the people, ironically, and she said, well, this poet or this wannabe poet came to my apartment door. So she can talk about each incident that's brought up, but overall, it's her disappointment and worry and anger that the press can be so gullible.
Oh yeah.
About these, and it's happened to a lot of people.
Right.
It's happened to a lot of people.
Unfortunately, we're past our time. Alice, I really appreciate, there's so much more. I think that, you know, the death of her father, she's had a lot of deaths and a lot of resurrections in her life, as she says, and it's a fascinating story, and it makes one want to read her books, and one knows where to look. So thank you so much for speaking with me. And
thank you, August. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.